First off, thanks to the organizers, especially Lucas and Chinka, for asking me to give the talk. I'm very happy to do so with this audience. There's a lot of great young people around. Let me start off by advertising. This is a picture of the Bardeen Quad, engineering quad at the University of Illinois. And so you can tell the university is very nice to you if you win two Nobel Prizes. So you can all strive to attain that goal. The second thing is this is a nice picture here. The physics building is back here. But just for all the great young people here, we're actually hiring a junior faculty member in condensed matter theory. So if you're interested, please apply to our position online. The deadline is coming up. The initial deadline is coming up soon. So today I'm going to talk about electrical multipole moments in crystals and also in insulators, topological insulators. So this is kind of a seemingly old-fashioned subject. So the idea of electric polarization of crystals has been around for a long time. So, you know, people have found, you can see in your Griffiths electromagnetic textbook, that people talk about polarized materials, dielectric materials. But it wasn't until the early 1990s where the sort of quantum theory of electric polarization in crystals was really nailed down. So that was by Vanderbilt and his collaborators in about 1993. And so since that time, there's a very beautiful theory which connects polarization to topological physics. In fact, if you saw Masaki's talk last week, he discussed some aspects of polarization and topology. But the idea of multipole moments, quadrupole, octupole, this type of stuff, is this type of theory for these type of moments in crystals is absent. Okay, so I'm going to, this talk is about how to develop this theory, and we give some models which have these non-trivial moments. So first off, let me tell you my collaborators. So one is my student, Vladimir Belkazar, who's a grad student in my group. The other one is Andre Bernadig, many of you probably know, who's faculty at Princeton. Most of the results in this talk are in a paper that was recently submitted. Some things on interacting systems are in preparation and have not been submitted yet. So the outline of my talk is as follows. First, I'm going to develop the theory of classical multipole moments to sort of go back and review electromagnetic moments. I'm going to then give an in-depth review of electric polarization in crystals. So everything you wanted to learn about electric polarization, I can teach you in part two, hopefully. In part three, which hopefully we'll get to, the interesting parts, we're going to talk about quadrupole moments and extensions. Between this and sort of the heavier theoretical portion, I'm going to give you some physical realizations of the models we developed in part three. And finally, I'm going to talk about how to describe the topological invariants which capture these multipole moments. So let's begin with the idea of what are classical multipole moments. So let's start with a monopole moment, which is just charge. I've got some charge. If I take a positive charge and a negative charge and I separate them in space, we get a dipole moment. The dipole moment is represented by sort of the weighted average of the charge by the positions of the different point charges. If I take two dipole moments with opposite dipoles, so the dipole moment cancels and arrange them, let's say, in this pattern, I can generate a quadrupole moment. This is the sort of quadratic weighting of the charge of each point charge. And if I take two quadrupoles with opposite quadrupole moment and separate them in 3D, I can generate an octupole moment. Okay, so this is sort of the classic pictures of configurations of point charges with different moments. It turns out that the intrinsic dimension of each of these moments is 0, 1, 2, and 3 spatial dimensions. So in order to generate a quadrupole moment, you have to have a minimum of two dimensions. If you have two dipole moments and set them on top of each other, such that the dipole moments cancel, you have no moment in 1D. You have to separate them in space. And so this requirement of spatial separation of the different charges implies that you can't really define these things except in their intrinsic dimension or higher. Okay. So let's think about, it turns out there's an important physical constraint on the well-definedness, the definition of each of these moments. And that's so they can be independent of the global origin of coordinates. So suppose I have a dipole moment, and I calculate the positions due to this in this coordinate system. If I shift my coordinate system by a vector r, it turns out the dipole moment, just from the definition of the point charges here, shifts goes to itself plus some quantity here, which is proportional to the shift of coordinates times the total monopole charge of the system. Okay. For the quadrupole system, if I do a shift there, the quadrupole moment goes to itself plus something which depends on the polar or the dipole moment plus something which depends on the monopole charge. And so in order for the nth moment to be well-defined and independent of the choice I make of the global origins, all lower moments must vanish. So if I'm going to talk about a dipole, I have to talk about a neutral system. If I want to talk about quadrupoles, I have to talk about a system which is not only neutral but has no dipole moment. Right? Now, sometimes you see people talk about configurations of point charges, and they talk about the dipole moment, even if it's not neutral. And the point is there is that you cannot sharply separate the effects of the monopole moment and dipole moment if the system's not neutral. And so if you want to sort of get a clear observable property related to each moment, you have to have all the lower moments vanish. Okay. And this gives us a strong restriction when we go start talking about materials where we want to study that quadrupole or octupole moments. So this is the picture for point charges, and let's now think about if we have a density of these monopole moments inside some material. So let's consider the polarization, which is the dipole moment per unit volume. So this is, as I said, it's only well-defined in a material which is neutral, so like a neutral insulator in this case. If I have some polarization, it turns out this has a measurable observable quantity, which is if I have a surface, I get a surface charge density, right? So the surface charge density sigma is connected to the polarization dotted into the normal vector at the surface. In this case, I have some positive charge on this surface and some negative charge on that surface. So the surface charge is an observable property of the polarization. Now, I can have a quadrupole density material, and it's only well-defined in a neutral system, which is also unpolarized. So I start off with a system with no electric dipole moment, and it's neutral. I can think about a quadrupole moment, so let's imagine the moment QXY. So if I have a slab or sort of a sheet of material with QXY with edges to the vacuum outside, it turns out that the quadrupole moment, instead of telling you you have a surface density, charge density, tells you you have a surface dipole moment. Okay. So there's a sort of nested structure where instead of having bulk polarization gives boundary charge, you have bulk quadrupole gives boundary polarization. Okay. And it's simply related here, which is that the polarization for QXY is the normal vector of the surface contracted with this tensor, and you see that you get tangent polarization to the edge in this pattern. Okay. So those of you who are well-versed in electromagnetism might notice that the edge polarizations are sort of converging and diverging to the corners, and indeed in this structure you'll get some corner charges in this case. And the corner charges are also determined by sort of taking the quadrupole tensor and dotting it with two normal vectors. So each corner has two normal vectors, which is the intersection of these two edges. So each edge has its own normal vector, and in this case we get the structure where the corner charge is related to the quadrupole density in this case. Okay, so quadrupole gives you edge polarization, gives you corner charge, polarization gives you surface or edge charge in this case. This is a sort of nested structure you find. So just so we don't get confused about units, it's important, and will maybe important later, in their intrinsic dimensions, each multipole moment density has units of charge. So in one dimension, polarization has units of charge. In two dimensions, quadrupole density has units of charge. In three dimensions, octupole density has units of charge. Okay, so in one dimension, polarization has units of charge because it's dipole moment, charge times distance, divided by the length of the system, which has units of charge. So you're canceling these units out. So this is just important to keep in mind when we sort of write these equations where I have the edge polarization, which is a 1D polarization, is equal to something dimensionless times something here, which has dimension, but this has the same dimension because this is a two-dimensional quantity, this is a one-dimensional quantity. So this has units of charge, this has units of charge. This corner charge is also units of charge in this case. So there's no hiding the units. This is sort of the nice structure you see. Okay, so it turns out that we will see soon, or if you're familiar with the theory, you know that in crystal systems, only charges and currents are the actual observable properties. You can't measure the polarization in a system, and we'll talk more about that in a little while. But the important thing is that the quantities you can actually measure, which are related to multiple moments, are the charges and currents that are derived from those moments. So like a boundary charge, a corner charge type of thing. And so it's useful to give an operational definition of the multiple moments in terms of these observable quantities. So let's give an idea about how you might do this with a dipole moment. So first, take an insulating wire that's neutral in the bulk. If I wanted to find a dipole, it's got to be neutral. So I take a wire. It terminates at some end in this case. And now let's imagine I attach some free charge to the boundary. So the bulk is neutral, but on the boundary, I'm just going to stick some charge there, or maybe some charge appears there. It's stuck to the boundary, the very end of the system, right? Now you can ask the question, so the system could be polarized, it may have a dipole moment throughout the bulk, but you can ask, what's the difference between the actual charge you find at the boundary and the free charge you attached? Okay. And the answer is the difference between the total charge on the end and the free attached charge is captured exactly by the polarization. So if you measured this charge and it wasn't equal to this red amount here, you would know the system is polarized. Okay. And so in this case, you find that the end charge minus the free charge is equal to the polarization in this case. This is a one-dimensional system, so everything has units of charge. Right? This would be a good way to define the polarization. You look at the surface charge of the system. You ask, how does it differ from the free charge on the boundary? And this tells you what the polarization is in this case. So, and as I said, this is just related to the fact that surface charge is the polarization dotted to normal vector. Okay, the quadrupole moment's a little bit more subtle. So let's look at the quadrupole case. Let's take an insulating sheet that's neutral and unpolarized. And let's imagine doing the other thing. Instead of attaching free charge to the boundary, let's attach some polarization just to the boundary. The bulk is not polarized, but let's attach some polarization to the boundary in this case. Okay. So we can write this polarization, these two dipole moments. Let's now ask, what is the amount of charge on the corner? Well, if we take a an area integral to capture how much charge is here, the area integral reduces to this sum over these two points and tells you how much polarization is entering, and you'll find that the corner charge is equal to the sum of the two boundary polarizations. Okay. And you can imagine that you know that bound charge equals divergence of polarization. Here we have polarization diverging, or in this case converging, towards the corner. And so you can imagine that the corner charge is equal to the sum of the two polarizations. Okay. Whoops.
You have to shut down the projector.
Well, that's probably not good. So my computer's still on. I'm not sure why the projector is off.
Did you hit a button or something?
Let's try one more time. Okay, let's go there. Okay. Okay, hopefully I won't hit that again if that was the button. Okay, so the corner charge is equal to the sum of the boundary polarizations. If I have a quadrupole moment, something different happens. Okay, so the quadrupole moment, I told you, gives rise to edge polarization. But you can see that the corner charge in the quadrupole moment is not equal to the sum of the two. I get some corner charge, but it's sort of shared by the two edge polarizations in this case. So the idea is that if I have a quadrupole moment in the bulk, P1 is equal with magnitude to QXY by the formula I presented on the previous slide. P2 is also equal to QXY, but the corner charge is also equal magnitude. This says that the corner charge, if I subtract P1 and P2, gives me the quadrupole moment contribution. So the quadrupole moment captures the failure of this equation to be true. It captures the failure of the dipole approximation, the dipolar contributions, to be the total contribution of the corner charge. So this is sort of an operational definition which gives me some observable quantity, which is related to the quadrupole moment in this case. Okay, so that's all I want to say about classical multipole moments. That's the sort of introduction now. Let's go now to start giving a review of polarization in crystals, which is quite a exciting subject. It's been, as I said, in the literature for a long time, and the sort of theory, the consistent theory materialized in the early 1990s, which I'll partially review now. So imagine we have a crystal. This is a representation of some unit cells with some ions, which are positively charged. And to the ions, there are associated some electrons in this case. Now imagine an insulator. So I've sort of drawn the electrons to some local objects. And to be precise, these electrons drawn here are sort of the Wannier localized wave functions. I can think about it that way. Let's imagine now that I generate a dipole moment somehow, and the electrons get shifted off to this configuration. So the polarization is equal to the dipole moment per unit cell in this case. And so if I look at this electron here, it's been shifted by this much, and I have this dipole moment. So this is my dipole moment, and this is, in this case, my dipole moment, and this gives me my polarization. And you see it's translation invariant. I'm imagining a crystal with translation symmetry, and so the dipole moment is the same for every unit cell. Right? But now let's imagine a separate process where instead of moving things to the right, I move them to the left. But now the final configuration is the same, but now this electron started off being associated to this ion, and so now I would call this a dipole moment. This is the same configuration as the previous slide, and so the question is now, which one is the correct dipole moment? And so the answer is that the actual answer is ambiguous in this case. So either answer is perfectly fine. It turns out they differ by an important quantity. They differ by essentially a shift of a single lattice constant in this case. Now, I can imagine a third, more complicated situation where instead of moving things by one unit cell, I drag them by two unit cells. So now I might say my dipole moment is from this electron here, which is attached to that ion. This is my new dipole moment. Right? I can compare with the dipole moment on the previous two configurations. And the point is that they all differ by some number, some integer number of shifts in this case. In this case, since the units are just electric charge, they all differ by an integer multiple of the electric charge. So in this case, the two blue lines differ by one. The red and blue also differ by one. And the blue and red here differ by two in this case. They differ by an integer amount. And so in each case, the 1D polarization differs by an integer multiple of the charge. And so the point is that in crystal systems, we have to identify the polarization with itself modulo an integer multiple of the charge. Okay, there's no way around this. This is the physics you get in crystals. And essentially, it comes from the fact that the position operator, which represents the dipole moment, is not periodic. It's an unbounded operator, if you write it as a Hermitian operator. If you want it to match with the periodic system, you have to do some kind of unitarization, which we'll talk about soon. But the point is that an unbounded operator, in this case, is not compatible with periodicity. And so this gives you this sort of, this is related to the ambiguity in this quantity by an integer multiple in this case. This is not the same ambiguity you find if you would shift the coordinate, the origin of global origin of coordinates, right? Our system here is neutral. There's one plus charge, one minus charge. This difference here is not related to my shift of my global origin of coordinates. So we've gotten rid of that ambiguity by fixing a neutral crystal. So the ambiguity is due to the choice of unit cell to which each electron is assigned. So I told you, in this case, I've defined my dipole moment as being this long blue arrow because I took this electron and I assigned it to this unit cell. But essentially, I could have picked any unit cell I wanted to, this one, whichever one. That choice is where this ambiguity comes from in this case. Right. So the nice thing that this ambiguity does is it does do something nice for us if we apply a symmetry. So it turns out that you can get a quantized topological value for the polarization if you fix a symmetry. So let's pick a symmetry under which the polarization is odd and then enforce it. So for example, inversion, reflection, 180 degree rotation, charge conjugation symmetries, these are all symmetries under which the polarization switch is sine. And if I enforce the symmetry, it means I have to obey this equation, which normally has a solution that p equals 0. But since this is only defined mod integer, this gives two possible solutions, 0 or e over 2. So 0 represents when they're on site, e over 2 represents the mid-bond site, which if we enforce, say, reflection symmetry, is reflection symmetric since we have a periodic array. And the nice thing is that in this case, this non-trivial e over 2 value indicates that we have a symmetry-protected topological phase with an observable quantity, which is this polarization, which is some quantized quantity in this case. So if I don't lift these symmetries, this is a quantized observable property of a one-dimensional insulator. Okay. So let's give an example now. So we can sort of relate this to a model. Let's think about a 1D insulator with reflection symmetry. So I'm going to draw everybody's favorite model, which is now is probably more commonly known as something like a Kataev chain, but previously it was looked at as what's called the SSH model, the Susher-Verhegger model. This is not; these are not Majorana modes. These are sort of single electron orbitals or atoms which have a single electron orbital per site. In this case, no spin. And I've got a system where this is my unit cell, and I have a bond, a strong bond, between every atom in the unit cell, and no hopping between unit cells. So this system, the electron density sits within the unit cell, so the polarization is naturally going to be zero. We have the other case, which is this clear topological structure here, where now I've got the strong dimerization, strong bond between unit cells. This, it will turn out, has a polarization of e over 2. We'll calculate that in a minute. And so we can take both these systems and we can try to calculate the charge polarization. So Vanderbilt and King-Smith told us how to do this. We do this by calculating the polarization in momentum space, for example. So we're given some Hamiltonian, the block Hamiltonian, associated to, say, both of these models with periodic boundary conditions. It satisfies, say, some mirror symmetry. So I have this operator and acting on h of k gives me h of minus k. So it has some mirror symmetry. I diagonalize the model. There's 2 degrees of freedom per unit cell, so it's a two-band model. And so I have one occupied band, and so I calculate the Berry connection, this vector potential. And where in this case, there's only one occupied band, so N and M only run over the one occupied band, so this is a number. And then I integrate it over the Brillouin zone and multiply it by a normalization factor. This is the charge polarization of the 1D system. And the reason this is the charge, one sort of heuristic way you can see why this might be the charge polarization is because minus I d by dk is nothing but something like the position operator, right? So this is like taking the expectation value of the dipole moment in some block wave function in this case. So there's a subtlety related to that, which we'll get to later, but this is heuristically what's happening. So let's do the calculation. This model has this block Hamiltonian. This model has this block Hamiltonian. The connection is 0 in the first case. The connection is 1/2 in the second case. I integrate, and I get 0 in e over 2. So it's a very simple problem in this limit. Okay. So this is sort of gives us the result for the boundary, sorry, the bulk polarization. We now want to relate this to an observable property, which might be, for example, the boundary charge. So let's now try to connect the polarization to the boundary charge. So the first case has no polarization. We expect no boundary charge. The second case does have a polarization, and we expect a boundary charge of P, which is E over 2 in this case. We expect the boundary charge, depending on whether we have a plus normal vector or minus normal vector, to be plus or minus E over 2. So if I diagonalize this model with open boundaries, you find the following energy spectrum. In fact, this is actually just a flat band, but I have some valence band here, which is completely filled. I've got a conduction band, which is completely empty. But at half filling, this only has n minus 1 electrons out of a total of 2 times n. So half filling is in, so I have one extra electron half filling to make it neutral, which I need to put in one of these boundary modes, these free sort of zero modes sitting on the boundary. And that's a choice I have to make. And if I pick the one on the right, then the charge density will be plus E over 2 on the right and minus E over 2 on the left. So this is the connection between the bulk polarization and the boundary charge. So there's some boundary modes which get filled or not filled, which tells us the addition or removal of charge in this case. Okay. So just as a reminder, this is the electronic contribution of the polarization. This Berry phase formula is the electronic contribution. To get the total polarization, you must include the effect of the ions. But for this talk, I'm going to assume all the ionic charges at the origin of the unit cell. So it gets multiplied by a factor of zero when you're calculating its dipole moment. But we must remember the system must be neutral, so we have to include the ionic charge. All right, so that gives you a picture of how to calculate the polarization in momentum space. We can now try to calculate the polarization in real space. Okay, so this is probably less familiar, I would say, than the Berry phase formula. So polarization is the dipole moment of the 1-year charge density. So it's sort of the you can think about in an insulator, especially in 1D, every electron you can think about is forming some localized atomic orbital, which is a linear combination, a wave packet of block waves built from the entire Brillouin zone, which is called a 1-year function. And in this case, for our model with P equals 0, our block function takes this form. If I just diagonalize that 2x2 matrix, I get this wave function. When I do the Wannier calculation, I just sort of Fourier transform this. The Wannier function of this band associated to unit cell R is given by this real space wave function. It's equally weighted on site N between atoms A and B in the unit cell. Okay? In this case, the Wannier center, the sort of average position is just given by N, the unit cell, times A. And if I subtract off the ionic charge in unit cell R, this has a vanishing dipole moment. So I sort of calculate the charge density of this localized orbital, subtract the charge from the origin of unit cell R, and that's the dipole moment in this case, which is zero. In this model, it's slightly different because this second wave function is translated by one unit cell. And so, in fact, in this case, the Wannier function is not only just a unit cell N, it's a unit cell N minus 1. This has a Wannier center, which is half shifted from N to the left in this case. Now, if I subtract off the charge density from the ionic charge in unit cell R, I find a dipole moment of minus E over 2. So in general, one-dimensional maximally localized Wannier functions can be chosen as eigenstates of a projected position operator. Okay, so this is important because we're going to use this technology later. So the projected position operator I'm writing in this way, if you saw Masaaki Yoshikawa's talk last week, you might be familiar with this. He wrote, I think this is like U of X, or as a unitary operator. This is basically a unitary version of the position operator, which maps all the eigenvalues of the position operator onto the unit circle, so it's compatible with periodicity. That's all it's doing. This is sort of putting everything equally spaced on the unit circle, makes it a unitary operator instead of a Hermitian operator. I have the ground state projection operator for my models in this case, which in this case is just my single particle projection on the law-occupied band. And I can form this projected position operator, and the condition that a wave function is a maximally localized one-year wave function in 1D is that it's an eigenstate of the projected position operator. And I can write its eigenvalue, which is a unitary phase, as 2 pi I over n times its one-year center coordinate. Okay? In this language, the polarization is nothing but the log of the determinant of this operator in whatever basis you write it in, real space, momentum space, whatever, times some normalization factor in this case. Okay. So this is sort of another way to get the real space value of the polarization by calculating the some property related to the projected position operator. You can now link the real space and momentum space pictures using this position operator. Okay. So the idea is that if you now write this operator in momentum space by Fourier transforming these guys and projecting onto this ground state, you see this operator is nothing but an operator which takes the band U minus at point K and shifts it to U minus the same band at K minus one unit of delta K. Right? So it shifts it by one K point to the left. Okay? And the point is if you take this operator to the n power, n is the number of lattice sites, in the thermodynamic limit, this becomes equal to the Wilson loop operator. Okay, so you can find out that if you take this thing to the n power, this operator becomes equal to the proportion of the identity matrix between U of k and U of k multiplied by a telescoping projection of all these wave functions onto their neighbors in this case, which can be written in the thermodynamic limit as e to the I integral of the Berry connection over the Brillouin zone. In finite size, this quantity here is not quite unitary. And so if you extract its phase turns out to be the important quantity, but it has magnitude less than 1. This is called the Wilson loop, in this case in the x direction. And this will become important because when we talk about quadrupole moments in a minute, we're going to come back to these Wilson loop operators, and they become crucially important. Okay, so just one last point. We can talk about the lattice ambiguity in both definitions. The lattice ambiguity comes from the fact that I can take each wave function and shift the phase for any value of k. These are all independent wave functions. If you diagonalize them on the computer, this number e to the I theta k will be a random number. Your computer, MATLAB, mathematics will give you some phase. If you can do something nice and make it a smooth phase value, the barrier connection shifts by a gauge transformation. The polarization shifts by the winding number of this formula. If the winding number is m, the polarization shifts by this integer in this case. So this ambiguity comes from the fact that my phase choice of my block wave functions is arbitrary. Right? In the real space formalism, if I make this phase shift to the block wave functions and do the Wannier calculation, you will find that the unit cell gets shifted by m units in this case. So what it means is I calculated the Wannier function for unit cell n, and what I find is a wave function localized at n plus m. And this means that the Wannier center for unit cell r has been shifted by ma, and so this shifts which unit cell my Wannier function is connected to, which one I told it came from in this case. Right? So I wanted to calculate it for unit cell r, but this electron is located here instead, not at r, which is just n times a. And so this shifts the polarization. So this ambiguity is not really an issue for observable, because it turns out all physical observables are always related to changes in polarization, and this ambiguity gets removed when you take differences, either in space or time. Okay, good. So that was a long review. So now if you didn't know anything about polarization, now you need to know everything you'll ever need to know about polarization. And now we're going to talk about quadrupole moment in crystals and extensions of this. Okay, so what do we expect if we want to generate a quadrupole moment? So going back to the classical picture, we expect that a quadrupole moment heuristically is formed from two dipoles. And if I can get a dipole from one occupied band, I'm going to need two occupied bands to have two dipoles which cancel out. Right? This is a heuristic statement, but it turns out to be true. So I'd expect I need at least two occupied bands. And in order to be well-defined, I want the polarization to be zero. Locked to zero. And one way to lock it to zero is to add a symmetry to make sure it's quantized, first of all, so it's either zero or a half, and then pick the choice where it's, find a model where it's zero. Okay. The second thing is that we need to choose symmetries under which, if I want to quantize quadrupole moment, I need to choose symmetries under which the quadrupole and the polarization are odd, so they're both quantized. And in our case, I'm going to propose choosing two reflection symmetries which are simultaneously imposed, mx and my. Mx quantizes the polarization in the x direction, my quantizes the polarization in the y direction. Either one quantizes the quadrupole moment x times y. Okay, so to do this in the minimal model, I'm going to start off with a system here where I have four sites per unit cell. Each site is like a single complex fermion orbital, so I'm thinking about spinless electrons. And I'm going to add some hopping terms in this case with strength lambda. So I add these hopping terms to form these squares. So the problem with adding these hopping terms is that if I solve, so now we see that the bulk is made up of these disconnected squares. The problem with these disconnected squares is that at half filling, they're actually gapless. So if I solve for the problem of a square type binding model, I find this energy spectrum, and at half filling, there's two states at zero energy, and so it's gapless. So I need to do something different. The thing I need different is to add flux through each plaquette. And if I want to preserve mirror symmetries, there's only one choice for the flux, which is pi flux. So if I turn on pi flux, the energies look like this, and I get this gapped system here. So this model here does not represent a gapped insulator, but this one does. So each of these dotted lines represents a minus sign. All the other lines represent hoppings of strength lambda, just real number hoppings of strength lambda. The dotted line represents lambda with a minus sign on it. And this is a gauge choice. I could have picked some other gauge choice, but this one is the simplest for my choice. This one preserves translation symmetry in this case. Okay. This model is very simple. You can make it slightly more complicated by adding the sort of intra-cell dimerization in this case, which is sort of another hopping parameter, gamma, inside the unit cell, which we'll talk about in a little bit. This one also has to have this flux structure. So you can think about this as a square lattice with pi flux everywhere, which is dimerized in the x and y direction. So it's like a pi-pi dimerization in x and y. Okay. So if the dimerizations were equal, it would be a pi flux model which has two direct cones. Yes?
So with respect to the reflection symmetries, they're preserved, but you have to make a gauge transformation.
Yeah, that's a great point. So we'll talk about that later, but you're absolutely right. So this model here has reflection symmetry, exact, honest reflection symmetries. This model here at best can have reflection symmetry up to a gaze transformation in the y direction. I picked a gaze, right? So the x direction here has reflection symmetry. The y direction, I have to reflect and then multiply things by a minus sign. Yeah, exactly right. Good point. And so that becomes crucially important later. Okay, so let's take this gamma wave for now so we can understand. So heuristically, how do we understand this model has a quadrupole moment? So I understand it has a quadrupole moment by cutting it. So first I make edges. So I make edges. We can see each edge now is a 1D SSH chain, dimerized chain. So each edge has E over 2 polarization, which is what I claim is important for a quadrupole, that the edges are polarized. Okay, I cut the other way. I see that there are two. So these edges also have E over 2 polarization. It turns out this bottom has minus signs, but if you solve the SSH model, it doesn't matter whether you have pluses or minus signs, or in fact any phase, you still get E over 2 polarization to happen. Okay? So both directions have quantized polarization in this limit, and the quantized polarization value is E over 2. If I cut in both directions, I see I get these free corner states, and so now we'd imagine that each corner is going to have corner charge of E over 2. Right? So I'm going to show this to you in a second, but this is the structure you get. So the model of the square model is important because if you cut it, you get the correct structure for the quadrupole in this case. And so we would say this model has a bulk quadrupole density of E over 2. Now this is a heuristic description. I'm going to show how this works later. And this is sort of the picture you should have in your mind. If I cut it, I get polarization. If I cut it in two directions, I get charge. Right? So let's actually look at the real properties of this model if I actually solve it numerically, or analytically, but I have some numerical plots. So I have these two parameters, gamma and lambda. And as a function of gamma and lambda, this is the energy spectrum on a fully open geometry, open in x, open in y. When gamma, the intra-cell hopping, is less than lambda, I get these corner modes, these zero modes here, which are locked to the corner. Everything else is gapped in this case. Okay. So you see here I sort of have this two structure. This set here of bands is coming from the edges, basically, and this sort of top set here is coming from the bulk. But the structure is inside this region here. I imagine I'm in some kind of topological phase. Outside, I imagine I'm in a trivial phase. Yes?
How sensitive is this plot to the shape of the lattice? If I don't make it a perfect square lattice, make some,
So it's not sensitive to making it rectangular. I have to keep reflection symmetry.
Sure, but that's right. But if I keep reflection, so you only mirror X and mirror Y, right? I can make a random shape like that.
Yeah.
Oops.
Yeah.
So that kind of a corner or something.
Yeah.
Is the zero mode
here? Good question. So the zero mode in this case is for a pristine corner.
Okay.
So if I make some kind of jagged edge like in graphene, then the plot will become more detailed. So there'll be some structure. So maybe you'll have multiple modes which hybridize in some way in this case.
But the E over 2 charge as the corner will still be preserved?
So in principle, the E over 2 charge, the corner will still be preserved as long as it doesn't hybridize with an odd number of corners. As long as it doesn't hybridize with an odd number of corners, right? Well, what happens if you make a jagged edge, you'll have multiple corners which sort of appear in pairs.
Right.
And so you will have, these things can hybridize, but you'll sort of have one mode which still gives you the E over 2 charge, mod integer in this case.
So if I make like a multiple corner as one big corner there, actually if I add them up, I would still have like a half integer charge.
You still have half charge, but you have to separate that edge from the other corners.
Different mode scale. Right? So I'm very, very
That's right. Yeah. So then it should still be E over 2 charge. That's a great question. So if we calculate the charge density in this problem, you see that in the bulk you get exactly 2 electrons per unit cell, which is our half filling. On the corners you get either -1.5 or 2.5. If you integrate around the corner, you find compared to the background charge is exactly E over 2 charge. This is not taken at this limit, it's taken for a finite value of gamma. And you can calculate the edge polarization. So you can look at the edge polarization, or the polarization sort of resolved in real space. In the strongly dimerized limit, you find the polarization is exactly a half right on the edges. The nice thing is that when it gets hybridized, with the intra unit cell hopping, you see the polarization decays in the bulk. So exponentially decays in the bulk, but the total amount on this half of the system is still a half in this case. Right? Which means that this edge polarization is not just a property of the boundary, it's a property of the bulk, because it penetrates in the bulk. It's not just something which is localized right on the edge. When you go into the trivial phase, there's no polarization in the bulk or boundary in this case. Okay? So you sort of get this picture here. We get strongly dimerized. There's some decay length related to the bulk gap here. And eventually you go to the trivial phase where you have no edge polarization. This is for polarization in the x direction. If you rotate it, you'll get the same. Or is it polarization in the y direction? If you rotate it by 90 degrees, you'll get a very similar plot with a quadrupolar pattern. So if you want, we can sort of count charges from this dimerized limit. If you want to see how much charge sits in the corner, you see that in this unit cell here in the corner, you have this ionic charge. This zero mode here is not filled, so I get zero charge from that. Each dimerized state from the SSH chains gives you E over 2. H square gives you a factor of E over 4, but there's two E over 4s. So in this case, you get exactly, you get exactly minus 3 E over 2 in the corner in this limit. And as you turn on a on-site hopping term here, this corner charge will spread out exponentially in the bulk, but it still will be localized in this case. Okay, so before I tell you about the topological invariance related to this, let's talk about some simple extensions. So the important thing to remember is that these topological phases are gapped in the bulk, and they have gapped boundaries.
All the topological state has the feature that the boundary cannot be screened by a low-dimensional thing, right? But it looks like I can attach a one-dimensional, in the first part, a screener.
This is a very important question. So I can attach, interesting question. Suppose I attach an SSH chain there.
Yeah.
Okay. That changes the edge polarization from E over 2 to E, let's say.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right.
Now, the topological feature is a property of the bulk. So this condition I have that the corner charge minus the two edge polarizations equals the quadruple moment is still satisfied, which means what will happen in that case is that the polarization here will be E, the polarization here will be E over 2. The sum of those things is 3 E over 2, but the corner charge will be integer.
Right.
And so even though I can change the edge polarization, that's not the observable quantity. The edge polarization cannot be measured. So the observable quantity turns out to be the difference between the corner charge and the sum of the two polarizations. So that will still be satisfied even if I attach things on the edge. If I attach things to both edges at the same time, then this is not a problem because then they both change by integer. So it just hits you, right? But if I only put a thing on one edge, indeed it's true the corner charge will be integer.
Yes.
My claim is that the corner charge is important, so to speak, but it's not the important thing. The important thing is that the corner charge is not equal to the sum of the two edge polarizations. That's still true. So the corner charge will be integer. But now I'm summing up integer plus half integer, which is not equal to integer. Yeah, that's a great question. Yeah. But there's more subtle. So if I keep C4 symmetry, I have to attach things to both sides, and this is not a problem. But if you just keep mirror, this is a really important question. So, okay. So these topological phases have boundaries which are gapped. It doesn't have gapless boundaries. It has gapped boundaries. But the gap boundaries themselves are in 1D SPT phases. So the back gap boundaries in this case are in a 1D SSH chain, in this case protected by some symmetries. It could be reflection, which look at here. It could be particle hole if you want something on-site. And so it turns out this model can be used to construct many types of 1D gap phases on the boundary. So for example, if I put 4 spin a halves coupled with anti-ferromagnetic interactions, you get a boundary Haldane chain on the boundary, just some dimerized spin a half Heisenberg model, or whatever model, Haldane chain model. If I put 4 Majorana bounds, four Majorana modes here, I get a boundary with a pi flux. I get a boundary Kataev chain. If I put 4 Zn parafermions with 2 pi over influx, I get some topological parafermion chain in the boundary. Okay, so this model is useful for constructing systems with gap boundaries, where the gap boundaries are in topological phases, and the corners will usually trap some kind of projective representation in this case. Okay, so that's one extension. The other extension is to actually take this model and go to 3D. The simplest extension to 3D is to look at a model with an octopole moment, OXYZ. So here's the physics of the octopole moment. I have a bulk three-dimensional system. The bulk has OXYZ. Each surface now has quadrupole moment. Each hinge is polarized, and each corner has corner charge in this case. So this is the sort of structure of the physics of the sort of observable properties of the octopole moment. I get surface quadrupole. I get this hinge polarization where two surfaces meet, and where three surfaces meet, I get this corner charge in this case. Okay, so this model in this case, we'd expect we need 4 occupied bands because you need 2 canceling quadrupoles, and it's quantized by keeping all 3 reflections, mx, my, mz. That will quantize all the lower moments as well, so they can be fixed to be 0. And so this is a model which does that. I have sort of basically take my two-dimensional square model and extend it to cubes in this case. Okay. In each plaquette, you still need pi flux in the system to keep the mirror symmetries, but I sort of have this sort of 8 objects per unit cell, and I connect them with this cubic structure. You can see the corners now will have this sort of free mode there. The surfaces now will have the same quadrupole model, and the hinges here will have the SSH chain model. So there's sort of this nested structure of these orthogonal models. Okay. All right, and this model, turns out, has octopole moment also E over 2. Okay, so before we get to the topological invariant, which is sort of the more complicated part, let's talk about some possible physical realizations. So it turns out we have at least three. Unfortunately, I don't have a chemical formula for a material, but I at least have three other physical realizations. I'll talk about two of them today. The first one is cold atoms and optical lattice. Optical lattices. It turns out this model is easy to make there, or not relatively easy, looking at what previous work has been done. So I take an optical lattice where I set up some kind of square lattice structure with interfering laser beams. I now construct the Hofstadter model. So this is something which has been done really nicely several years ago and has been looked at further from there by both Bloch's group and Kettley's group. What you do is you turn on a potential which makes it hard to hop in this direction, for example. In this case, they use a magnetic field gradient. It makes it difficult for the atoms to hop in this sort of horizontal direction. Then you turn on the hopping again by activating it with some slightly detuned laser beams, which gives you enough energy to hop to the next site. And because of the sort of phase difference in laser beams, this generates flux in between every unit cell. And in fact, Bloch's group used pi over 2 flux. Kettley's group used pi flux. So creating large fluxes is not hard. In fact, it's easy to do that. Usually in these type of systems, getting a large flux is difficult. But in this case, it's easy, or it can be made to have pi flux relatively easily. And then what you do is you take your traditional optical lattice and you add superlattice harmonics to it. So you add extra periodicity to it, so you dimerize the hopping in the x and y direction. And this will generate this type of model where now each flux has pi flux through every plaquette. So this model can be made using cold atoms just by building a Hofstadter model with pi flux and adding some superlattice harmonics to it in this case. The second place this can be made is in photonic waveguide arrays. For example, here's a picture here of waveguide array in fused silica. This is from Mikhail Rexman's group and at Penn State. So here basically you have these photonic waveguides. In this case, they're slightly elliptical. But you imagine basically that you have photons which can propagate perpendicular to the screen, and they can evanescently couple to their neighboring waveguides. And so they can spread out in this case. And this model, these types of systems can model tight binding arrays. So we can sort of construct here some picture of these waveguides, which can be sort of bored into this fused silica with a laser. The problem is how to make pi flux, because these are like sort of like elliptical s orbitals, or sort of very simple wave functions. I guess elliptical s orbital is not really a right term, but they're simple wave functions. You can't create phases in the hoppings very easily. So it turns out that if you want to drain pi flux, there was a group paper came out this year which shows you how to make a negative coupler. Basically, if you want to create a negative sign in the hopping, you stick an auxiliary site between two sites and tune the on-site energies, which in this case means the on-site refraction indices. And because of the super exchange process here, you can generate a negative coupling. And so if you take this sort of structure here and you add these sort of auxiliary sites between them with properly tuned indices of refraction, you can generate this pi flux model. Yeah.
Band structure for photon, right?
So you're not going to measure charge in this case, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. You can measure the localized corner modes or things like that in this case.
Okay, so you have photon zero modes.
You can measure you can measure photon zero modes, and you can probably measure there's pumping processes you can measure as well. But photon, there's no charge. So the nice thing is that if we do this and you put in parameters which are realistic for these type of fused silica arrays, you find out you can generate the topological model you want with these auxiliary modes which are strong, far separated. So these modes here are coming from these extra auxiliary sites. These modes here form the topological bands I wanted to form with these extra corner modes here. So it's possible to form these in these photonic arrays. Okay. So any questions before? We talk about how to describe the topological invariance related to the systems. All right, here we go.
I don't think I quite understood. So in these models, you're saying that basically this corner charge is protected by reflection symmetry.
I'm saying that the bulk quadrupole moment is protected by reflection symmetry.
Oh, so if you don't have reflection symmetry, what goes wrong?
Oh, the bulk quadrupole moment can be there, but it won't be quantized. It may not be quantized. Furthermore, if the polarization is also non-zero, then what you call the quadrupole moment is arbitrary in that case.
Right. So reflection symmetry is kind of the way you protect against this bulk.
It's one way to protect it. C4 symmetry should also work. Particle. There's other symmetries that work. In this case, I understand the story best for reflection symmetries. Okay, so the idea is that these models have topology on the boundary. The boundary represents some topological chain itself. Okay, some topological insulators, some SPT. But I want to be able to diagnose the surface topology from the bulk. Can I do it without making a cut in the system? Okay. Because cuts, edges are sensitive, as Chinka said. You can put stuff on the surface. I can do whatever else to the surface I want. You know, lots of things can happen on the boundary. You want to be able to diagnose the topology from the bulk ground state wave function in a periodic system. Okay. So we had these models for a long time. It took us a long time to figure out how to do this. So the first part of the talk we kind of understood very well for a long time. This part of the talk is where it took us a while, and you'll see why it becomes complicated in a minute. But the structure actually turns out to be logically nice once you understand, or once you see it. So the idea is we have this bulk, the boundary is topological, as I mentioned earlier, protected by some symmetries. You want to be able to diagnose this with periodic boundary conditions. So how do you do that? Okay. So we know that the polarization, the lowest type of the dipole moment can be captured by the Berry phase or Wilson loop of the occupied block bands, or equivalently by the projected position operators. And it's natural to extend this by sort of saying, what are higher dimensional versions, or what are sort of more complicated versions of the Berry phase? Right? The problem is that the first thing you try, which is that the extension of the Berry phase to 2D is the Chern number, which is not correct. So that fails. Okay, so immediately you're stuck, because if you try to extend it easily to 2D, you immediately find something which doesn't work. It gives you something which tells you the Hall conductance, not related to a quadrupole in this case. So the question is how to do this, right? So let's consider, first of all, these Wilson loops in higher dimensions. So we need to sort of build some structure with the Wilson loops, and then we can tell you to calculate these invariants. So let's think about a Wilson loop in 2D. So I integrate the Berry connection and kx. This is still a function of ky. I can do the same thing. I can integrate the Berry connection aky along the y direction. This is still a function of kx. These type of, and you can think about these things are related to the projection position operators in the x and y directions, parameterized by this other momentum in this case, this sort of remaining momentum. These type of objects have been used previously to characterize different types of topological insulators, and so let's see what people found in those cases. So let's take, for example, the Wilson loop in the x direction parameterized by ky. This is sort of a diagram here of the two-dimensional Brillouin zone. I calculate this in the x direction, and I sweep this Wilson loop in the y direction. And what I do is, as I do this, I plot the eigenvalues, let's say, of this operator. And what you find for a Chern insulator is you get this structure. It's a function of ky from minus pi to pi. This eigenvalue shifts by 1. And by 1, this means one lattice unit in this case. Right? Because these eigenvalues are representing here the Wannier centers, which are naturally normalized on the scale of the lattice constant in this case. So I sweep ky from minus pi to pi. My Wannier center shifts by 1. Right? So this is the same thing as the quantum Hall effect, right? I change ky by 2 pi, which means I thread flux in the system, and my electrons move by 1 unit. So the Chern number is 1 in this case. Right? It's like the lattice picture of the quantum Hall effect. In fact, you can think about this Wannier center in the lambda level problem as sort of calculating the guiding center as a function of ky, which would give a line on this curve. So this is a more complicated curve because it's a Chern insulator, it's a lattice problem, but this is like the integer quantum Hall problem, very similar in this case to what you'd find there. You shift ky, something shifts by 1 unit in this case. Right. If it had Chern number 2, this would shift by 2 lattice constants, but in this case, it's just by 1. Right. If you do this for a quantum spin Hall effect, you find what you might think you find. You find one band going one way, one band going the other way, and these are time-versal partners of each other. If you calculate for a weak topological insulator, which are like stacks of SSH chains, which is polarized, you find like a flat band in this case. This flat band in this case tells you that there's sort of a set of charges which sit on the boundaries, so the system has a non-zero charge polarization in this case. Right? If you calculate for the quadrupole model, this is what you find. So you find that the bands in this case don't hit 0, they don't hit pi, and they don't touch each other. All right. So the idea is that we're going to take this Wilson line, and we're going to define a sort of fictitious edge Hamiltonian in this case. Right? So we're going to say that these eigenstates here, these values here, represent the eigenstates of some kind of fictitious edge Hamiltonian in this case, similar to what you do for the entanglement Hamiltonian. If some operator you define it to be equal to some entanglement Hamiltonian, in this case I'm going to call it an edge Hamiltonian. It's some Hamiltonian which represents the Hamiltonian of these Wannier bands in this case. So in this case, my Wannier bands are gapped. And what you find is if you take one of these gap bands, it has a non-trivial quantized Berry phase, right? So in every other case, right, these are gapless. All these cases are gapless. I can't separate them out. In this case, they're gapped, and that means they can carry their own topological invariants. So each of the Wannier bands itself can carry its own topological invariant. Right? What this says is that if I call this the edge Hamiltonian, this says that the occupied band of my edge Hamiltonian is polarized. It has a Berry phase of pi, in this case, in the correct direction. In the y, so I calculate this in the x direction, and this will have a Berry phase of pi in the y direction, which means it's the x edge is polarized in the y direction. Okay?
There's no physical edge.
No physical edge, yeah. This is a pure boundary problem, right? So there's a paper, actually, this paper with you in Israel, which discusses the connection, the adiabatic connection of this Hamiltonian to the entanglement Hamiltonian edge, which is, you know, where this idea comes from. In our paper, we cited your paper, so sorry. But yeah, so there's a nice paper by Israel Lucas. Is one an author? You don't even know. Okay, so that's that. So there's a really nice paper. Tom Jackson, sorry. Yeah, a really nice paper which shows this is where we got this idea from. Or was that the this type of operator here, as well, and for free fermions at least, can be adiabatically connected to the edge Hamiltonian, just like the entanglement Hamiltonian can. So this, there's a way you could do this with the entanglement Hamiltonian, but it's slightly, but this way I would say is the sort of proper way to do it because it's related to positions, whereas the entanglement Hamiltonian is not quite the same. Okay, but that's a point. So the idea is this: you have the energy bands for the quadrupole model because of the mirror symmetries. These occupied bands are doubly degenerate. So you take them, and then you run these Wilson loops in the x and y directions. You find they're gapped in both directions. And in fact, what you find is the Berry phase of each of these of the lower band in both cases is pi. And so identification of the quadrupole phase is that it's characterized by pi Berry phase of the Wannier bands. It has to be in both directions. Not, one's not just good enough. So you need both edges to be polarized with pi. It turns out we may have a proof that shows in order to get gapped Wannier bands with reflection symmetry, if you want them gapped in both directions like this, the mirror symmetries cannot commute, which comes back to Fiona's question about the fact that your mirror operators are only true up to a gauge transformation, which forces them, in this case, not to commute. So for spinless fermions, you get non-commuting mirror operators with having flux. But it actually turns out if you use spinful fermions, which I didn't use here, they actually will naturally not commute in those cases, usually. So with spinful fermions, you don't need to add this pi flux. That minus sign comes from like a time reversal breaking factor or some spinover coupling. But the idea is that to get this type of gap structure, you have to have non-commuting mirror symmetries. Right? If you have mirror symmetry and they commute with each other, one or the other will be have gapless Wannier bands in this case. So first of all, before we move on, this is kind of interesting. So what I'm saying is that both edges represent topological chains, right? But what I'm saying is that the corner, in this case, if both edges are topological, these two topological chains are meeting at the corner in this case should naively have an even number of modes because I have two topological chains meeting there. Right. So this is sort of a puzzle. What's going on here? This is very similar to this puzzle, which says that the corner charge should be the sum of the two polarizations. Right? I've got a polarization here, polarization there. If I look at the corner charge here, I get the sum of the two. But in the quadrupole, we see we get a polarization there and a polarization there, and the corner there is sort of a shared charge by both polarizations. And so nicely, and you can see in this case there's only one mode, it turns out the corner mode is a simultaneous zero mode of both edge Hamiltonians. It is not a conventional domain wall state. So if you actually calculate the zero mode away from this limit, for example, and you look at the a bound state problem for this edge, bound state problem for that edge, and you calculate this wave function, you can show it's a simultaneous boundary mode of both, whereas in this case, for example, it would be like a domain, it'd have to be like a domain wall state. So you'd have one trivial phase, one topological phase, and you get like a domain wall mode in this case. Okay. So the structure of the quadrupole moment enforces this to be this sort of simultaneous zero mode, which means the edge polarizations here, you don't just add them up to get the corner charge. Okay. Now, this method of using Wilson loops to me, my student Vladimir is the person who came up with this idea, when he came up to me, it seemed very ad hoc. It seemed like a very, okay, well, this kind of seems to work, but it didn't seem to me like to be the right answer, okay? And so it wasn't until we understood the connection to the octupole moment where I really believe this is sort of the proper way to characterize the system. So let's go to the octupole moment and see what we find, and then we sort of see the structure repeat itself. So the octupole moment has a bulk octupole moment, the surface is quadrupole, the hinges are polarized, the corners are charged. So we're going to use nested Wilson loops to characterize this topological invariant. So the idea is that the energy bands, you have fourfold degenerate energy bands in this case. You calculate the Wilson loop of the occupied bands in one particular direction. And it turns out if you do this, they split into two sets of two degenerate bands. Okay? This represents the Hamiltonian of the surface perpendicular to the z-axis. And so it will turn out, that this two-dimensional Wannier band has the same topology as the quadrupole model, right? Which means that it has the surface quadrupole moments. Now what you do is you calculate you take these two occupied bands, and you calculate the Wilson loop on those two occupied bands in a different direction, the y direction, for example. This will split these two bands up into two more bands, which are gapped again. And then finally, you calculate the last one on this last band, and you find it's either 0 or pi. And if it's pi, in all three directions, if you permute these indices, you do all these in different orders, then it's the octopole model. And so what you find is you get this nested structure of observable quantities, like quadrupole, polaris, and octopole, and you also get this nested structure of Wilson loops, which matches the result. And a non-trivial result is that if you have reflection symmetries, you can show that the Berry phase of these Wilson loops is quantized in this case. So it doesn't have to be that the Berry phase of this guy here is 0 pi. It turns out reflection symmetry quantizes it to be 0 pi. And this answer for the octopole model is independent of which order I do this. And so here's an example here of what you find. So here's the bulk energy bands. I calculate the Wilson loop in the z direction. I get two quasi-two-dimensional energy bands. I calculate it in the y direction, I get these sort of quasi one-dimensional bands, and these one-dimensional bands have a pi polarization. No matter which order you do this in, you find pi for the octopole model. Right? So the octopole phase has pi Berry phase of nested Wilson loops, no matter which direction you look at.
What happens if it's not pi on some edge?
So if it's reflection symmetry,
that violates the...
So what it could mean, so if it's reflection, it violates it. It could mean that you've broken the symmetry slightly. So for example, if all these remain gapped, but the Berry phases are not pi, what that means is you've kept symmetries to keep the polarization and quadrupole locked to be zero, but you've shifted the octopole moment slightly away from, say, U/2. Like you've just changed it to make it a non-quantized value. Usually what happens is that if these other quantities become non-zero, you'll get a mess in the Wilson loop structure, or something else can happen. But the point is, to understand what the octopole is doing, these other moments, the bulk quadrupole, bulk polarization have to be zero, and they have to stay locked. And so if you release some of the symmetry so that the octopole can change and the other ones can't, you might get a Berry phase which is not equal to pi, which would indicate a non-quantized octopole moment in this case.
I just refer to what if it's zero.
Oh, if it's zero, yeah, good. So yeah, so if it's zero, yeah, so you can find a case where it's zero in one of the directions and say, or in other directions. Those are phases which are represented by phase transitions where the bulk energy gap does not close, but the Wannier Hamiltonian closes, right? So it's like an idea, if it's like an edge, there's an edge, it would be represented like an edge phase transition. And so the idea is that it's similar to what happened in the entanglement spectrum. If you had a phase transition in the entanglement spectrum, between two gapped entanglement bands, but the energy spectrum didn't close. So in this case, you can show that you can close. So this topology is protected not only by the bulk energy gap, but also this Wannier gap. And so if the Wannier gap closes, you can have a phase transition between these phases in this case. Good. So I'm out of time, so let me just, I'll flash a picture of some pumping process you can get where you get quadrupole pumping, and I'll stop to take questions here at this time.
I understand correctly, your symmetry protected multiple states, subclass of more general symmetry protected topological basis.
Yes.
How does this fit into more general classification using homology and so on?
Yeah, it's a good question. So the I don't think it doesn't fit yet, right? So I think these represent, for example, these things. Well, maybe it does, but maybe, I mean, I don't know the answer. But these things, to me, represent something more like these extended TQFTs where you have sort of extra topological gap phases in the boundary. I mean, you know, it's similar in spirit to electron topological instead where you can have sort of a gapped symmetry-preserving topological ordered state. These just have gapped SPT states, something weaker than that, right? That's one sort of idea here. Now, there's also this idea of how you characterize it. In this case, we characterize it by taking your ground state and then resolving it in real space. That's what these Wilsonlets are doing. It's saying we can't resolve it in energy space, the bands are touching, but we can split them by resolving it in using some other operator, right? So you might do this by, for example, using the Tyrosol operator, right? We use the Wilson, the Tyrosol operator, say, well, we maybe have spin up and spin down. You can calculate the Chern number of two of these bands separately and then say maybe that you can keep that as a double conductor. In this case, we're using this Wilson loop operator to separate the bands, look at the topology separately. And I mean, this is the first place this has been done, but it doesn't mean that it doesn't fit into some kind of, you know, structure which already exists, which if you bury down into, you'll find, right? So we're characterizing, using the same topological invariance, polarization Chern number, but of something where you've used this Wilson loop operator to split the bundle, right? You've got some bundle of occupied states, which you could split arbitrarily. Right. At every point in space-time, if I have two in Brillouin zone, if I have two occupied bands, I can choose an arbitrary linear combination. In fact, I could choose a linear combination which makes these two states topological. But if I can't observe it, that doesn't mean anything. In this case, the thing that makes it observable is the fact that this operator, which allows me to split these bands, can be measured because it happens on the edge. It's related to what's going on the edge in this case.
I'm quite curious about the chalk function. So one dimension chalk function is a Chern number, right? Mm-hmm. Which is another parameter. So what is the analog in 2D?
So one analog is you can take this model here. So we want something. The nth multiple moment needs n adiabatic parameter deformations to get something observable. So polarization needs one, quadrupole needs two. So for example, the corner charge is like two edges hitting each other, right? That's like two deformations. I can also have an edge and a time deformation. So in order to get a current, in the quadrupole case, I need to have an edge and a time deformation. So this model is an example here. And what you find is that the pumping represents a Chern number in this Wannier band space. So I have a pumping parameter plus the Wilson loop operator in, say, the KX or KY direction. And in this space, that polarization changes by integer. And what it means is that the edge, on each edge, there's integer charge pumped in this case, in this quadrupolar fashion. So there's some Chern number associated with the Wannier bands, but in an extra parameter space.
Other questions?
Jeremy?
Yeah, so is it possible to write down some sort of a continuum description of the boundary?
Yes. Yeah. So the so in fact, in this model, the continuum description is just a gap Dirac model. Right. So it's a gap Dirac model which represents the minimal model for a gapped 1D topological insider. The non-trivial thing is how the gapped Dirac model on this edge is related to the one on that edge. And so the one way to prove that this corner mode, for example, is a simultaneous edge state is to look at a continuum model where you derive the edge theory, which is a massive Dirac model. You look at some domain walls, and you show that because of the relationship between the Dirac model on the vertical and horizontal directions, that the zero mode is a simultaneous eigenstate in that case. But a continuum description of this model like that was just fine in this case.
How do I predict the charge? I mean, especially whether it's a positive charge or negative charge, when I have a curvature kind of thing on the boundary. I thought this is one feature, right? If you have some curvature on the boundary, you see a localized charge.
So good. So it's a good example. So it turns out, corner charge and corner zero modes are not equivalent to quadrupole moment. So there are examples of other two-dimensional models, like I wrote down here, which have bound states on disclinations, right? And those models, turns out, don't have quadrupole. So there are several papers, so I had a previous paper which has this type of structure. It turns out those models do not have quadrupole. And that confused us for a long time because we were concerned that every model with corner zero mode would have quadrupole moment. Those models actually have commuting reflection operators. But it turns out that those models can have polarization on one direction, but not the other direction. So what they'll have is they'll have a half charge. They can have a half charge on the corner, but it comes from the fact you're adding E over 2 polarization to 0. So it has the dipole addition rule. And so this model I wrote down here, this quadrupole model, if you use this sort of, will not have bound states on disclinations, actually. So it's not a curvature defect in this case. But there are corner charge models which are there because of curvature defects.
So Mike currently talked about sort of classifying SVTs with spatial symmetries in terms of sort of trivializing them away from mirror planes to looking at what happens on the mirror planes or maybe intersection of mirror planes, like whether you trap lower dimensional SVTs. Is this at all related? Can you think about it?
So it's not really. So the So we're talking about crystalline phases, so in principle it could be related. The idea is slightly different. It's like saying, that construction is, it's similar to saying if I took this model and I put a potential on it, which say preserved reflection, but broke translation symmetry. So that I only have, if I have translation symmetry, I have many mirror planes, but say I only have one, right? And so then you might be able to boil down this topology to something happening right on those mirror planes. And I haven't thought about that, but it could be happening. The other thing is it might be possible to extend what he was doing to a translation invariant system by, instead of considering a mirror plane, you consider sort of this Wilson loop operator or something like that, but I'm not sure.
You said you need the lower bounty force to vanish. Does that mean lower dimensional index has to vanish in such a case? You have some 1D index.
Yeah. So for example, the two-dimensional model. So if you want to have a well-defined quadrupole, you need the weak invariance to be trivial. And one way to see this is because if you don't have a trivial weak invariance, the boundary will have charge because it's polarized. And since the boundary is not neutral, you can't define an edge polarization, right? And so, furthermore, if the system has a weak invariant, the Wiener spectrum is gapless, because there will be a band of states at least at a half or at zero in this case. So, for the models, so it might be possible, although I'm not sure, to relax this to saying that the polarization is just quantized and you could subtract off some background, but I don't think that's possible, right? So, at the very least, you need the polarization to be quantized, to be either zero or half. It might be possible to relax it to just say it could be a half, since you know what the value is, but I don't know how to do that yet.
You don't need any translation, right? You just need a 20 over.
Well, I mean...
Although the formulation seems to need translation, but...
It's true. So what you can do, so in fact, I've shown the Wilson loops calculated moment space. Instead of Wilson loops, I can use projective position operators. I can calculate, in fact, for disorder systems with say, reflection symmetry. And what you find is that the projective position operators break up into bands of states, and you can take those bands and calculate the... So you can do PXP, which will break into two bands. You can calculate PYP on one of those other bands to get this invariant in this case. So you can do the calculation in real space, which does not require the Brillouin zone.
So you do need both mirror symmetries.
I need both mirror symmetries.
So maybe, my suspect, this is maybe related to what Lukasz was asking, is maybe some Z2 cross Z2 even weaker index, so that each of the Z2 index, the mirror index is trivial, but you have something else.
I mean, it could. Yeah, it could be the only. It could be that that's the case. The only problem is that all the systems that Herman Lee was talking about have gapless edges, right? Or flat bands of states, right? Yeah. These are systems which have gapped edges, and you want them to have gapped edges because they're topological in this case. So, it might be possible to take those models and deform it this way, but there's something slightly different in this case. I'm not saying that using his analysis on this type of system would be interesting to see what you get in this case, right? It may be that you can describe it perfectly that way, but I'm not sure. It's not quite the same.
You didn't mention any solid-state realizations.
Yeah.
Do you think that's because it'll be really hard to find this in solid-state systems, or just you haven't really looked carefully at that problem?
So we haven't looked carefully at it yet. The difficulty, I think it's likely you'll find it, right? I mean, if I'm only requiring mirror symmetries, there are tons of materials with mirror symmetries, okay? Now, and I showed the spinless case, but a spinful case is fine in the system, right? So, I mean, I think that people will find it. I think that we haven't, Andre has some friends that do density functional theory. Most of my close friends don't do that, so I couldn't bug them to do that. But I think that it's possible to find in this case. I don't have a good lead on a material. I don't have a chemical formula yet, which I wish I had. But
you don't see any real reason why?
I don't see any real reason. Yeah, I don't see any real reason. I mean, because the symmetries are sort of natural symmetries you have. We've actually checked to see that if you had disorder that kills reflection, that it's preserved on average, you still see the nice quantization on average. And so even then, it's not that fragile, right? The question is, back to what Cinco's asked, like if the edge reconstruction does something, is it going to destroy the effect? So the answer should be that it doesn't. And so then, but I don't know. But it'd be nice to find it in the computer first and then make a prediction of the real material. But the main problem is that this has been a complicated thing for people to look at for a long time. And so they might not have, the the really bright people who do this type of stuff, like Vanderbilt and stuff like that, just haven't had this type of, used this type of calculation yet. And so once they put that into their codes, if they do, hopefully they'll find something right there. Or there's nothing a priori that says this is not, this is too fragile.
Anyway, maybe you can read the offline.
Okay.